Greetings, and welcome to Endeavors, broadcasting to you from wherever you are, wherever you may be going, or wherever you may have been. My name is Dan McPeak, and I'll be guiding you through this storytelling for the next hour or so. Of course, on terrestrial radio, we are available at CJSF 90.1 FM, CHSR 97.9 FM, CKDU 88.1 FM, CFMH 107.3 FM, CICV 98.7, Cape Radio, and The Scope. Before we start the show, I've got some big news. If you're a friend of mine or a regular listener to the show, you know that in the last couple weeks I've been trying to go more digital and become more of a podcast, and that's now happened. Endeavors Radio is now available on both iTunes and Stitcher. You just have to search up Endeavors Radio and you will find it. Also, we now have our own website, which will host not only Endeavors Radio, but also a couple other podcasts that we're going to announce soon. The website is www.podswithbenefits.com, and that is also the name of our Facebook page as well. My thanks to my partner, Liam and Ma, for building that, designing that, and getting that all up and running. And we also have a new Twitter account as well, pods_w_benefits. All new Endeavors Radio episodes will be posted to both the website and potentially the Facebook page as well, and we will start tweeting out soon. Also, stay tuned for Lehman and I's upcoming comedy-centric podcast, I'll Drink to This. It's a much lighter-hearted show than what you are currently listening to, and that will also be hosted by Pods with Benefits as well, and will also be available shortly on iTunes and Stitchers. The first episode should be available in about a week or so. So once again, Endeavors is now available on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to visit us at podswithbenefits.com. Okay, now on to the show for today. And it's a good one. It's a good one, yes. You may remember a couple of weeks ago, I had on a musician, Steph Connor, and we talked about her album with the lyre ensemble called The Flood, which was sung in ancient Sumerian and Babylonian, and was mainly composed on the lyre. Well, we've got something similar today. I spoke with a musician, Lucas Harris, who is working with Early Music Vancouver on an upcoming production of Dido and Aeneas. And one of the instruments he plays is called the arch lute, Theorbo arch lute, sort of one of the ancient instruments of the lute family. First appeared in 16th and 17th century early Baroque music. And it's kind of a nice follow-up and contrast to the chat I had with Steph Connor a couple weeks ago. So you'll hear about how Lucas got into sort of the idea of more traditional style of music and traditional instruments. And how we contrast that with the music of today, with, you know, electric instruments plugged in, and even how technology has changed music, and his thoughts on recording live shows on your phone. I know for me that's a big sort of pet peeve of mine whenever I'm at a live show and I see people standing a few feet away from the musician or the performer and holding up a screen and watching it on there rather than just taking it in for what it is. So we'll get into Lucas with all that and so much more, like why he thinks Greek stories make for such good librettos and such good dramatic storytelling. You're also going to hear from Alec Owensworth of Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah. They're on their 10th anniversary tour, and they just recently remastered and re-released their debut album from 2005. And so what they've done is they have 24 tracks. They've got the 12 originals, and then they've got the 12 again sort of as bonus tracks and remastered. And, you know, they're usually a little bit longer. So I'll talk with Alec about that and the decision to remaster those tracks and sort of that whole process, what goes into it, if you will. But we're going to start with a song from Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah. This is Upon This Tidal Wave of Young Blood.
Just
My first guest is a musician and scholar, and he studied early music at the Civica Scuola di Musica di Milano as a member, as a Marco Fodella Foundation scholar. He is the founder of the Pluck Band, known as the Toronto Continuo Collective, as well as the Southern Italian folk group known as the Vesuvius Ensemble. And he's also studied at the Hochschule für Kunst Bremen, and he's a lutenist with the Tafel Music Baroque Orchestra, and he's a regular faculty member of said Tafel Music Baroque Summer Institute, as well as Oberlin Conservatory's Baroque Performance Institute, and has recently joined the faculty of the Vancouver Early Music Festival's Baroque Vocal Program. He has been a guest music director with the Pacific Baroque Opera, the Ohio State University Opera Program, and Les Voix Baroques, and will also direct the Emperor's Chapel at the Toronto Consort, which he did this past February. He just completed his Master's in Music in Choral Conducting at the University of Toronto, and he is pleased to have been appointed the new artistic director of the Toronto Chamber Choir beginning this season. His recent recordings include the Solo City Baroque Lute Recital, as well as a collaboration with the violinist Genevieve Gillardot, the Bach Weiss Sonata. He is Lucas Harris, and I spoke with him earlier today. All right, Lucas Harris, thanks so much for joining me today.
Happy to be here.
So I'm curious as to how you got into early instruments and early sort of Baroque style instruments and music.
Sure, it was basically kind of the bridge between my two musical worlds. When I was a teenager, I did very serious amounts of both classical guitar and jazz guitar, and would switch back and forth, you know, between electric guitar and classical guitar all the time. And at some point, I discovered early music, and it seemed to just perfectly bridge those two worlds, because I was interested in playing and being a part of musical performances of classical repertoire. But at the same time, I didn't want to give up the kind of improvisatory aspect of playing electric guitar. And especially when I discovered continuo playing, you know, which is the Baroque period art of improvising an accompaniment over just a bass line that the composer gives you, I immediately thought, well, that's just like comping chords in jazz, but it's a different way of writing it out. And it made immediate sense to me. So it was a little bit like I found the thing that kind of both aspects of my musical upbringing prepared me for, in a way.
So at the upcoming concert, you're going to be playing something called the Arch Lute. What is it about that in particular that you found fascinating or find fascinating?
What is it about that instrument that I find fascinating?
Yeah.
The prefix arch just means big, right? So just think of like an archbishop or an arch enemy or something like that. So it's basically a lute with a big neck extension that gives you an extra octave of really low bass strings. And what I love about the arch lute is it has more range than most of the other lutes does. So I've got, about four octaves of range, which is really quite a lot for any instrument during this period.
And does that have something to do with the fact that it has a second peg box? I mean, how does that alter its sound at all?
Yeah, so this extra neck extension, as I mentioned, houses this extra octave of bass strings, and it basically goes on to this long neck extension. And the reason for that is the same reason why, you know, the bass end of the harp is bigger than the treble end, or the bass end of the piano is bigger than the treble end. The bass strings just need to be longer in order to not be too thick. Once you get bass strings that are too thick, they just don't resonate very well, and they don't have very much carrying power. So they went to the trouble to design this very awkward-looking instrument with this long neck extension that that gives you these extra bass strings, but once you hear them, they're terrific. They somehow have a lot of presence tonally, but they decay very quickly, so you can pop one of these bass notes, and it just gives you a little sense of excitement that, boom, you know, adding something that's really amazing to the texture of a Baroque orchestra, but at the same time, it's very easy to sing or play over because it decays very quickly.
And what is it about, you know, the instruments like the archflute or theorbo or sort of others in that family? What can they do and what can they add that perhaps a guitar or a bass or sort of the more modern string instruments can't?
Yeah, one of them is just that they have a different kind of sound. You know, they were produced in an era that had a different aesthetic. And so the sound is not quite as powerful, but it's also much more transparent and kind of magical in a way. The lute, of course, has double stringing, almost like a 12-string guitar. So it has that kind of shimmery effect, you know, that you only get when you have two strings resonating in unison. Almost like, you know, the equivalent is like a violin section versus a solo violin. That's one thing. Another thing is that, as I mentioned, some of these instruments have a bigger range than a guitar does. So my archflute goes all the way down to G, like an octave below the bottom of the bass clef. And so that's kind of fun to be able to just, you know, play these really deep bass notes that go completely off the end of guitar. Another thing is a little bit harder to describe, but that the sound of these instruments has a kind of way of blending together, especially together with other instruments in a Baroque continuo section, like the harpsichord or the organ or the viola da gamba or the Baroque cello. Everything kind of melds together in a magical way, so that the continuo section almost feels like one instrument, even in the way that like a really great rhythm section in a jazz combo will do, like, you know, have a guitar and a piano and a vibraphone and a string bass, and when they all get going together, you don't so much hear the individual tonal qualities of four different instruments, you hear a kind of a blended accompaniment carpet of sound that's very enjoyable to sing or play over for a soloist.
It's one of the things that strikes me about sort of that period of music is the sound is much more, I guess, like peaceful or lamentable compared to some of the sounds that may come out of more modern day electrical instruments. Is there something to be said for sort of the naturalism of acoustic?
Find when you're playing completely unamplified is that you know, your gestures, you know, like in order for things to sort of read in a concert hall, you have to make your gestures pretty big. You know, it's almost like speaking without a microphone in a big hall, right? Like in order for people to hear what you're saying, you have to kind of make everything really clear and obvious. And if you want something to sound a certain way, you have to really go like almost as far as you can in that direction. And there's something kind of nice about that when, you know, it completely changes. The few occasions where I do play amplified, suddenly I find myself playing completely differently because I can hear all the teeny little subtleties in the playing that normally only I can hear. And so it's like I feel like I've just been painting a house with a huge paintbrush, and now suddenly I'm painting a miniature with a little teeny, teeny, tiny brush. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it really changes everything. I think that there's something kind of wonderful about just dealing with the sounds that these old instruments made, and solving problems, you know, without using any kind of mixing board or anything like that. Sometimes, you know, if one instrument is a little softer than another, you solve the problem by just putting them, you know, a little bit closer to the front of the stage, or just by asking the person behind them to play a little bit less, or putting them on a little riser, or making sure your music stand isn't kind of blocking your sound, or playing a little closer to the bridge, you know. And it turns out that there's so many different ways that you can, solve those kinds of tonal issues or balance issues without the use of electronics, and it's wonderful to explore those things.
You know,
it feels kind of more natural, as you say. Like, it feels kind of more, it feels nice in a way to be kind of forced into, finding solutions that are not based on modern technology. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, on that note, I was going to ask about how you think technology has changed not only the sound of music, but I guess our approach to playing it.
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm trying to think how to answer that. Certainly amplification is a big aspect of that. As I said, it just makes you play completely differently. One thing that maybe one way I can answer that question is to talk a little bit about recording. Nowadays, we have such amazing equipment for recording ourselves and for editing ourselves, so much so that your average classical CD will just have like hundreds and hundreds of cuts in it, right? And so they'll just kind of take little bits of this and little bits of that and edit everything digitally until it sounds almost perfect. And as a result, I think as listeners, we've kind of gotten used to listening to perfection. and we've also gotten used to, even when we perform, sometimes we have that model in our head somehow. And I think at the time, in the Baroque period, they didn't know anything like that. You know, there was no way to preserve music. Music was, it was an ephemeral event. You know, it was something that just happened, and then you just kind of remembered what happened at a particular performance. And, you know how memory works. I mean, we all remember the details that we want to remember, or that we choose to remember. So I think that really affects, kind of how we play. Sometimes one of the summer workshops where I teach, at the end of the 2 weeks, we have a big student performance, and a lot of the students want to record the performance with their phones or with their, Zoom devices and so forth. And we tell them, just for this one time, this is an informal performance, and we know that your grandma probably wants to listen to it, and you'd like to send it to her and so forth, but let this one performance just happen. Let it be a moment in time that will never come back, and appreciate it for what it is. And just, play your best and just carry the memories of this performance into the future. And I think that's a really special thing. It's not something that we experience very often nowadays.
Well, I want to pick up on that because, whenever I'm at a reviewing a show, whether it's, like a rock concert or folk or any type of music, there's always a proliferation of cell phones, taking photos or videos. And that always bugs the hell out of me because I'm like, you're only a few feet from the performer and you would rather watch it through a little screen on your phone. What does that say about society today that we're acting like that?
I don't know. I've been thinking about that for a long time. I remember even asking that question before the age of cell phones. I remember once in college, my parents came. They drove 6 hours from Arizona to California to come hear a performance I was doing with the orchestra, and they brought a video camera, and my dad videotaped it. And as soon as the performance was over, they went immediately home and watched the tape. And I just thought, that's so strange. It's almost like the performance didn't exist unless you could see it on a screen or something. It's like that was the proof that it really happened. And you had this kind of documentation of it. You could watch it as many times as you wanted to. But I can't help thinking that, by doing that, sometimes we miss the kind of spontaneity of the performance. And we're also kind of not, maybe we're not with the performers, because any performance is kind of a give and take between the performers and the audience, right? And the two feed off of each other. And if there's this kind of middleman, you know, this kind of device that's taping the performance, you know, that really changes the dynamic a lot.
Yeah. So should we do away with the, you know, like big concert films or big sort of rock documentaries, or do you think those still have a place?
I think they certainly do have a place, and I do think that, you know, live recordings can be really exciting. I mean, some of my favorite CDs are live concerts. And you know, what I find is that even the classical groups are starting to do that more and more, just because of the, you know, the digital editing thing. You know, some groups are just getting so tired of this business of chopping up the music, and they just feel like all the most musical bits get left on the cutting room floor, if you know what I mean. And a lot of classical CDs end up having this kind of cold quality where everything is in tune and you know, kind of saleable, but a lot of the personality of the performance gets taken away. And so I know, like, a string quartet that will just, you know, they'll tour a certain program, and then they'll plan that the final performance will be in their home venue, which is back in Boston at Jordan Hall, and they'll just say, whatever happens in this performance is going on this CD. And a lot of the audience members will jump to actually pre-order that CD, because they want to have it, you know, as we were talking about, there's something attractive about having this documentation of the concert that they were there at. And I don't know, I sort of feel like more classical and non-classical groups might be going a little bit more in that direction, because I think we're realizing that we're losing something of the kind of spontaneity of music making through how easy it is to record it now.
Speaking of performance, I know this year EMV, Early Music Vancouver, is performing Dido and Aeneas. This is not a light work by any stretch of the imagination. How does one prepare for a work of that scale?
Oh, just by certainly a lot of planning and you know, kind of researching the repertoire and, you know, making sure that you've got a great cast and a great orchestra. And yes, it's true. It's not a light work. I mean, it's definitely a big tragedy. Although, the other side of the coin on that one is that it's actually a pretty short work, and you know, it all kind of happens in less than an hour without any intermission usually. And apparently, it was, you know, the one documented performance we have evidence for is this performance that happened at a school. In the 17th century, it happened at this Chelsea boarding school, and we don't actually have any record that it was ever performed at court, and so it was possibly actually written to be performed at this school, so it's basically kind of like a school play, if you will.
Interesting.
never really meant for the professional stage, although there are also other arguments that that's probably not the case, because this is getting a little bit too scholarly, but there's another opera from just before Dido and Aeneas called Venus and Adonis by John Blow, who's one of Purcell's teachers, and Venus and Adonis has almost the same structure as Dido, and it was actually like kind of an important precursor to Dido. And Venus and Adonis was performed at court, but recently they also found evidence of a performance at the same Chelsea boarding school that Dido was performed at. And so now there's a theory that Dido may have had the same procedure, you know, where it was written to be performed by professionals at the court, and then later a second performance at this girls' school was planned. And they probably brought, you know, some of the, you know, elements of the production that this girls' school wouldn't have had, like male singers, for example, and, you know, a full orchestra and so forth. Anyway, I'm not really answering your question. This is something that I find very interesting. You'll read that in a lot of, you know, when you research Dido, you'll see, people will say that it was written for this boarding school, but it the evidence points to that, but there's a lot of really strong arguments that, in fact, it was meant to be a courtly kind of mask performance that was later redone at this girls' school.
A lot of sort of classical Greek tales, tragedy or otherwise, they often show up in opera. Why did pieces like that make good librettos? Is it sort of the contained epic nature of the story?
I think so. A friend of mine used to say, if you were to ask him for the two most important books to read to learn about 17th century music, they would be the Bible and Ovid. Because, you know, all the sacred music is, you know, written at biblical stories and liturgy, and all the secular music is written about Greek mythology. There's something about Greek mythology that they just loved, and I think it's partly because the stories are so rich. They're full of all these fantastical things, but at the same time, all the characters are real. You know what I mean? Even the gods and goddesses, you know, they experience jealousy and hate and anger and lust and the full gamut of human emotions. And somehow it makes it kind of safe in a way to experience these really heavy emotions if they're happening to somebody who was, who lived a couple centuries ago, maybe rather than a character that somebody would make up today.
What do you enjoy most about the Aeneid?
Well, what I like most about the Dido story, and in a way the most dramatic and compelling part of the Aeneid, is that it has this kind of classic feel of the men are from Mars, women are from Venus kind of syndrome, where there's these two young people fall in love, and the boy, Aeneas, is he's totally in love with Dido, but at the same time he feels this responsibility towards the community and his duty, and so when he's told that it's time to stop messing around with Dido and, go back and found the city of Rome, he says, okay, sorry, Dido, I gotta go. I gotta go to work. Whereas Dido is more like an impetuous teenage lover. She thinks that nothing is more important than her love for Aeneas, and that nobody's ever loved as much as she has. And, her focus is a little bit more on the relationship. It's kind of funny in a way that both the fact that Dido was performed in the 1680s at this girls' school, and the fact that a lot of student performances of Dido are done, even up to the present day. There's something I always associate about this story with young people. Almost the way that you would associate Romeo and Juliet with young people. It's this really passionate young love that's just a little bit more than the characters can handle somehow. And you have this sort of classic, male-female dichotomy, with the male being a little bit more in the world of duty and the female being a little bit more like in the world of emotions and relationships. And there's something incredibly powerful about that. And I think that, especially for young, the young teenage girls that would have been a part of that first performance of Dido, or maybe the second performance, if that other argument is right, there's almost like a warning in place. It's like, be careful of love. Don't fall too hard, or you could have the same fate as Dido, where her bow just leaves her, abandons her on the shore, and, she has no choice but to kill herself.
And finally, we're talking about performance here, and with a love story like Dido and Aeneas, what is it about that theme and sort of that whole style of performance that makes it much more timeless in comparison to maybe a more modern form of storytelling like the movies?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. I mean, I think that the big themes are really all-encompassing. of love and of duty and of connection and disappointment and heartbreak. I mean, those are things that we never seem to tire of hearing about, right? I mean, just turn on the radio. And yet we get to experience it with this totally gorgeous music, and also a lot of comic scenes, you know, to kind of relieve us of the heaviness of the tragedy. You know, that's something we don't always remember to talk about, that, you know, that. So in the middle of this tragedy, you have, they inserted this witches scene, you know, and witches were really popular right around that time, and it appeared in a lot of theatrical productions in the Restoration Theater. And so they had to have a witches scene, you know, and then there's also this sailor scene. They had a bunch of sailors that were about to leave the Trojan shores, and so, hey, let's do a little bit with the sailor, you know, and so there's another really funny scene. And they were really great in the Baroque about switching, you know, back and forth between the tragic and the comedic. And in fact, it happens a lot with longer operas, because a lot of Baroque operas last 4 hours, and it's just too long for a modern audience to sit through. And very often what they'll do to cut the opera down is get rid of the comic scenes, because they don't really advance the plot. And it's funny, if you've ever been to a production where somebody does that, you really have the feeling that something is wrong, because suddenly the serious characters have the full responsibility of bringing forward the dramatic momentum of the whole evening. And, the piece really wasn't supposed to work that way. Even Dido, you know, coming in at under an hour, it's not a very long opera, but they still felt the need to insert these comic bits.
Well, it's a very fascinating piece and a great look at sort of older, more traditional styles of music. And it will be July 30th, if I'm correct, in here in Vancouver. Lucas Harris, thanks so much for your time today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Daniel.
All right, cheers.
All right, have a great day. Bye.
That was Lucas Harris, and I spoke to him earlier today from Toronto. We are going to hear another song from Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, 10th Anniversary Edition. This is Details of the War. Thank you. next guest is the founder of Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, which recently celebrated their 10th anniversary. And to honor that milestone, re-released and remastered their debut self-titled album. They also have three other albums out. In 2007, Some Like Thunder, 2011, Hysterical, and 2014, Only Run. In 2009, my guest released his solo debut, Mo Beauty, while also concurrently releasing Skin and Bones, the debut album with his other band, Flashy Python. He is Alec Owensworth of Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, and he spoke to me last week. Alec Owensworth, thanks so much for joining me today. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah is re-releasing their debut album in celebration of the 10th anniversary. What prompted this decision?
It seemed the right time, you know, 10 years. Seemed a reasonable time to revisit. I remember my 10th birthday, and it was a big deal.
Now, I know you guys are remastering it. What goes into that? Like how different would a remastered version be than the original?
It depends on who you have remastered. I mean, we had T.W. Walsh do it, and he's really good. You know, I think the original, we did it so quickly that I think originally it was probably mastered incorrectly. I thought it was mastered for CD, but not many copies. Like, the vinyl was mastered for CD. Not many copies got through that way. We eventually came around to master it for vinyl. But it was, like, you know, sort of a novice mistake. But anyway, we had a master for vinyl properly. But TW's take on it is a little bit different.
The band, of course, is very different than it was 10 years ago. You had three members leave in fairly quick succession, Robbie, Lee, and Tyler. How tough was that for you when those guys left?
For them, the time was right. And I always suggested to everybody that if they felt that they needed to pursue other things or pursue, I mean, from the beginning, that was my suggestion, was that they should, you know, if another opportunity came up or something like that, then they should go ahead and pursue it. So it wasn't a tremendously difficult. Obviously, like, a couple of things need to be reworked, but you know, I think they did a great job while they were around. And since then, it's been different people at different stages, you know.
How has that affected touring? Because I'm reading now that you do a drum machine sometimes when you're on tour.
Yeah, but not very often. That was more for Only Run. There were a couple, maybe two songs in the set used a drum machine, and it's usually a drum machine paired with real drums. So I don't know. It's not like we're going to electronic music or anything like that.
Right. But I guess one of the issues, bigger issues that it raises is, that's kind of what music is that a lot of the time it's these short, you know, bursts of creative projects, often rather than a long-standing group, unless you're somebody like the Stones. Would you agree with that, or would you say that it's more a mixture of both?
I don't know. I mean, it depends on the project. Some people decide that they don't particularly want to pursue it anymore, and I think that that's on them. I mean, whether or not this had any great success or anything like that, I probably would have kept going anyway. That's just the way it is for me. But I don't know. I can't speak to the way other people go about things. So
I don't know. I mean, maybe in the past it was a little, possibly it was a little easier for a band like the Stones because there were fewer bands around and they had something unique and they just kept following it. And people gave them, you know, there are a lot of bands who are continuing. You know, the National is a band I could pick off the top of my head. I think War on Drugs have been around for quite a while. You know,
It happens. You know, given that you're sort of the only original member of your band left, how would you say what Clap Your Hands Say Yeah is now? How would you contrast that to your solo album that you released a couple years ago?
I think a lot of it has to do with instrumentation. Like, I think from the get go, I had pictured Clap Your Hands as leaning towards synthesizers a little bit more than other. I mean, even when we started, I was working on other songs and other albums, and I think some of the stuff that I was doing with other people, you know, I probably wouldn't put a pedal steel on a Clap Your Hands song, or, you know, I would do some more folky, I guess, Dylan inspired material for other stuff that I probably wouldn't use for Clap Your Hands. Clap Your Hands is a little more synth heavy. That was the primary distinction, really, for me.
Is that the beauty of having more than one creative project? Is that you can sort of have one for one style and one for another style, rather than trying to combine everything into one smorgasbord of sounds?
Yeah, I think so long as you have the capacity to distinguish between one and the other. I think a lot of people have different projects and they all kind of sound, you know, there's nothing really to define one or the other. For me, I have a picture, you know, to me personally, I have a picture of what I want a Clap Your Hands song to sound like. I mean, the album might change from one to the next, but they still all sort of hang together. You can see that when we do a live concert, if we play, you know, songs from each record in a particular order, they all hang together. It is a relief to try to do something else, especially, like, you know, directly after you've done something like a Clap Your Hands album and move on to something else that's entirely different.
I know you're about to start a tour, and given that you're celebrating the 10th anniversary, are you going to be playing mostly songs from that album, or are you going to throw in some new stuff as well?
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things about this tour. It's an opportunity to play the entire album from beginning to end. And we concentrated quite a bit on making the order all together in such a way that it was meant to be listened from first song to last. So I think it's a nice little opportunity to present it that way. Now, it's only 38 minutes, so I think we have to stretch it out, and the second half of the show is more newer stuff, you know.
When you play a song live, how different is it for you than when you're recording it in the studio?
It's a lot different. Usually you're not able to do quite as much unless you use backing tracks, which I never have. So you have to figure out how to make the song stand up with a sort of more limited palette, which can be an exciting opportunity, like, you know, to try to do that. It's going to be a nice challenge. But I think when you do it live, you just, in a spare form, like if you played with four people, something like that, and the song seemed to stand up, it's a good test for the material itself. I mean, when I play it by myself, if it seems to stand up, it's the best test, I think.
We live in an age where so many fans are, you know, listening to the singles or one or two tracks off an album. How important is it for you to expose your fans to maybe the songs that aren't quite as popular that you do? And is that a good impetus for playing an album all the way through?
Well, you know, I mean, that's the thing. For me, I don't really know. I think it's important to expose them to the entire album, to everything if you can, you know. I try not to put songs on albums that I don't feel entirely confident with. I think it's important. On the first album, I don't really know what constitutes a hit song. I mean, I remember people talking about singles early on, and I had no idea. I mean, to me, one thing that might be a hit for someone is just not, that doesn't feel that way for me. So I feel like, if you approach everybody individually, some people love Give Me Some Salt, for example, some like On This Tidal Wave of Young Blood, some like, you know, some of the stuff, Details of the War or whatever. So I don't really know what, it's not like I can't get no satisfaction or something like that, and that's what we have to keep playing. It's not like we have any singles like that. So, yeah, we just try to hit the whole album.
Would you say you have a favorite song off this new remastered album?
Yeah, I would probably say, I think In This Home on Ice still feels great to play. On This Tidal Wave of Young Blood, those might be my two favorites.
Well, clap your hands, say yeah, we'll be in Vancouver on the 18th at Electric Owl. Alec, thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Alrighty, cheers. And that's the show for this week. My thanks to Lucas Murray, and my thanks to Alex Owensworth of Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah. Also, my thanks to Hannah Van Borick of Laura Murray PR, as well as Nathan Walker for helping me get those interviews together. We're going to take you out with a final song from Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah. This is In This Home on Ice. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and we'll see you later. Bye, everybody. Bye. So sad, and I'm quite right. For more information about Endeavors, you can visit podswithbenefits.com or you can email info@podswithbenefits.com. To request an interview, you can email endeavorsradio@gmail.com. I make this show with Liam and Ma. If you go to the website, you'll see a donate button. If we really appreciate the support. Thank you.